The old nursery rhyme says, Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. All the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty together again. The question of this morning's message is this. I think we're all appreciative of the grace and the love of Jesus Christ. And we know that the Lord calls us back to him continually. And we should never forget that and never take it for granted. There is no question of that. But I'd like to add something else. The Lord seeks to do more than just forgive us. I understand I just used that word just. But I'm suggesting that there's more to what he does. He seeks to rehabilitate us. He seeks to bring us back to 100% the people that we were before, perhaps even better. And the question of this particular message is how he did that with the Apostle Peter. Peter, as you're aware, was an individual who erred grievously. But I think about Jesus looking at Peter when they first met, and the suggestion that Jesus had seen something special in Peter. In John chapter 1 and verse 42, we read of this. He brought him to Jesus. Jesus looked at him. I always wondered what the expression on Jesus' face must have been as he looked at Peter. What was he doing? Looking into his eyes, looking into his soul, looking into his personality. He said, "So you are Simon, the son of John. You shall be called Cephas," which means Peter. You know that, of course, what he's doing is saying, you're a rock, you're strong, you're solid, you're dependable, others can lean on you. Well, of course, he wasn't that at all. He was impetuous and he was inconsistent. And there were times that he expressed magnificent truths, and other times he said things that were thoroughly stupid. He wasn't reliable at all. But it looks to me like Jesus was looking at his man and saying, I can see what you can become. I can see the individual that you one day will be. Now, you know, of course, that Peter later on denies Jesus three times. Jesus wiped out. Peter wiped out. He described Jesus three times as someone that he didn't know. It would be hard for Peter to recover. I don't think there's any question. When he burst into the night and he wept bitterly, as the Bible very graphically describes, you knew that that was the low point of his life. It would be hard for his colleagues to accept his return. It would be hard even for Peter to forgive himself. Now, it seems to me that that's what we're talking about here when we speak in terms of rehabilitation. Because, can I put it this way? What a huge loss for the early church if they did not have Peter as their leader, their spokesman, the individual who, until the Apostle Paul, was the main person in the early church doing the things that he did. Now, think about how an appalling loss it would be with him still broken, still in pieces, still shattered, still unable and willing to put himself together, and no one else willing and able to put himself together so he could become the leader that the church so badly needs. Webster's Dictionary, we're talking about rehabilitation. To rehabilitate means to restore to a condition of good health, ability to work or function, salvage, restore, recondition, reconstruct, refurbish. I want to note several things here. Restore to a condition of good health, right? Bring them all the way back. And then it adds the ability to work or function. So he's able to do all the things that he needs to do as an individual, or she needs to do as an individual. And Peter's broken. He's not able to function. Yes, he's remorseful. Yes, his heart's broken. Yes, he knows he's messed up royally. But no, he's not put back together again, not yet. If I can do an analogy, you can think of an athlete who perhaps has a very severe injury. Down he goes. His knee is twisted out of shape. He's torn an ACL or something like that. And of course, we have good doctors and they put that knee back together, they do the surgery. But you know that he's not ready. It's not like he walks out of surgery and says, okay, I'll be your star wide receiver again. That's not the way it works. He'll have to rehab. Right? And so you can picture him going to the rehab, and you can picture him doing the exercises, the ones that strengthen the muscles and put all the joints back together until the day comes that his athleticism is fully restored and he can go out there and fly down the field and leave the earth and bring that catch down the way he originally did. He's not rehabbed until that happens. And I think about Peter, and I think Peter's not rehabilitated either until he becomes the individual he was before, perhaps even better, if that would be possible. Spiritual rehabilitation suggests two things. Number one, God's gracious forgiveness. Let's never forget that. God forgives us, He's graceful. Number two, God enabling us to resume the role of discipleship as before. And the idea here is that Peter will be able to come back and to be the Christian, the disciple, the individual that he was previously. Now, the wounds are healed, but the muscles and sinews also need to be capable of doing those muscular things or the spiritual things, as the case may be. Now, you know that Peter was remorseful. I think about the passage in Luke chapter 22, verse 61 and 62, that describes the heartbreak of Peter when he realized what he had done. And the Lord turned and looked to Peter. Can I ask it again? What must have been the expression on Jesus' face? Earlier, Jesus had looked at Peter, the man he had first met, and then he proclaims him a rock. Now Jesus looks at Peter wordlessly, for Peter is in the courtyard, and Jesus is inside the house of the high priest. He turned and looked to Peter, and Peter remembered the saying that the Lord, how he had said to him, before the rooster crows today, you will deny me three times. And he went out and wept bitterly. I picture a man's man. I picture a fisherman. I picture the hardened, calloused fingers of a working man. I picture a man that had been sunburnt out there on the Lake of Galilee. I picture a man, all these things, broken to the point that he weeps like a baby. That's an extraordinary moment. This is quite common in Scripture, I should point out. Saul of Tarsus spent 3 days and three nights in Damascus fasting and praying, Acts 9 and verse 9. David prayed that the Lord would create in him a clean heart in Psalm 51 verse 16, verse 10, I'm sorry. The prodigal son only came back to his father from the pig pen, according to Luke 15 verse 70, and Peter bursts into the night and weeps. You know, in all the happy, happy, giddy expressions of worship that seem to be popular these days, and don't misunderstand me, I think there's a certain victory and a certain celebration in worship that we ought to enjoy, that there also ought to be a place in our worship for heartbreak, for remorse, for weeping over sin, for regretting what we've done. I suspect the Lord's Supper ought to be one of those times when we say to ourselves that death on the cross was necessary, not just because of the people out there who sinned, but because of me. And perhaps it's worth weeping over that just once in a while. Perhaps it's also worth weeping over people that I know that need to be Christians and who are not. Perhaps that's worth weeping. I remember towards the end of the semester at Fried Hartman, one of the Bible teachers, I won't mention his name, but I looked across and there was a particular moment in a song and you saw him drop his head like that. And I realized he is weeping. And I thought, you know, sometimes young people don't get that these guys are the real deal. That these guys really do love the Lord and really do care about people and really want to serve the Lord. And I come back to this and say, yes, I think perhaps there are times we should weep. I'm not saying every Sunday, but I suspect that an appropriate response to a worship service sometimes ought to be tears. Tears of heartbreak and remorse for what we've done. Here is Peter in that particular place. And then Jesus comes to him in this scene, if I can try and set it. It's early morning. It's by the Sea of Galilee. The sun is just coming up over the east. There are some mighty mountains on the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee. They rise up to 7,000-8,000 feet. They're rugged mountains. So can you picture the sun peeking up over that? Bold and red and beautiful. Can you picture the light coming across the lake? Can you picture the fishermen coming to shore? The sound of the waves coming up to the shore? The sound of the rope being attached to a dock or a stick or something like that? Can you imagine the sound of the men clambering off the ship and onto the seashore? And can you imagine looking across and seeing a glow from a fire? Because there is Jesus and he is cooking some fish on the fire. The fire is a charcoal fire. In fact, a particular specific kind. It's an anthracite charcoal fire. And as the men come across, perhaps it's not quite full daylight, and you can see only faces in the glow of that fire. And as the day then begins to broaden and brighten, then you begin to see figures as they are. And there is a conversation between Peter and Jesus that I think is 100% purposeful on the part of Jesus. I suspect Peter doesn't want to talk about it. I suspect Peter, if he does talk about it, wants to do it only briefly, because it is, can I use the young people's term, like totally awkward to talk about his mistakes, right? John 21, 15 through 17. When they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" And he said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Feed my lambs." He said to him a second time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Tend my sheep." He said to him a third time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said to him, "Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Feed my sheep." Yes, Jesus is rehabilitating his man. Jesus is saying to himself, this man, Peter, is too valuable to be lost to the church. I look out across the congregation here, and I'm going to say that there's not a one in this room who's not so valuable that the Lord will do what he can to bring you back and to rehabilitate you, to put the pieces together again. And there are individuals who, if I can say it this way, who are not here this morning, who perhaps ought to be, and the Lord wants to do the same thing for them, to put the pieces back together again. Jesus' effort to rehabilitate his follower is an important model, I think, for us. I want you to notice how you look at this. Jesus never says, "Oh, Peter, what you did, that wasn't no big deal. What you did wasn't a problem." He doesn't say that. He takes Peter's actions seriously. For Peter's actions were serious. He had greatly and gravely let the Lord down. But Jesus is also aware of the other individuals around. Can you picture the other apostles listening to this conversation? Can you picture the raised eyebrows? What's Jesus doing? I know they're accustomed to Jesus doing strange things, but what is Jesus doing at this time, speaking to Peter and asking him this question three times? In this scenario, the chastened individual will bring a new sense of humility, it seems to me, and dependence on the Lord. I think about this. Somebody will say, "Well, do we really want a leader in the church, a Bible class teacher or a preacher or the like, who's made a mistake?" Now, I have two responses. Number one, my first response is, that's the only kind of human there is. People have made mistakes. The Bible is pretty clear on that count. The second thing is, if you have a leader who thinks he has never made a mistake, you don't want him for a leader. He's arrogant and unfeeling towards other people who do make mistakes, you see. Now, it's interesting the interplay here. Jesus says, "Do you love me?" That's what he asked Peter. Now, the Greek language is very specific, and that's one of the reasons why it was such a marvelous tool for expressing the gospel of Jesus Christ. There were actually four words that the Greeks might have used for the word love. Now, in English, you have the word love, L-O-V-E, which could stand for the Lakers or America or the Lord. And then there's the country in Western love. It's love. Is that right? L-U-V? You know, where the cowboy loves his pickup and loves his dog. And am I doing a good job of the southern accent? Well, I'm joking to try and make a point. In English, we have only one word, love. And it covers an extreme amount of things. The Greeks are very specific, and they said, no, there's this kind of love for this scenario, that kind of love for that one. Let me go over them briefly. Storge. The Greek word storge refers to family love. Brother and sister, parent, child, that kind of thing. The natural love that a family would have. Secondly, there was eros. Now, your mind shouldn't go rushing off to another place. Eros simply meant romance, or boy meets girl, or the violins, or the heart thumping when he saw her, that particular special young woman. Eros was romance. And then there was phileo, which is one of the words that's used in this context. Phileo is best friends, close friends. who revel in each other's company, who enjoy being together, that kind of love. And then the final one is agape, which is an altruistic love, which is where you're committed to the other person regardless of what happens, where you love that person and want the best for him, whether he is worthy of it or not, right? That kind of love. And so it's these last two words that I played with in this little context. So Jesus starts out, if I could put it this way, Simon, do you agape me? Do you have this deep commitment, no matter what, to me? And Peter responds, yes, Lord, I phileo you. My heart and my feelings and all that I have loves you. And Jesus says a second time, do you agape me? And Eve responds, I have a phileo love for you. And then the third time, Jesus switches to the word that Peter is using. Do you have this heart feeling for me? And Peter says, yes, Lord, you know all things. You know that I have this deep heart feeling for you. Now, the first thing I would like to say is that sometimes we suggest that agape is a superior kind of love. I don't think that that's the case. I think that there's something else going on here. You see, there is a person who loves somebody else deep within the heart with the feelings and the emotions that people who love each other do have. Whether it's romance or the other kinds, friendship and brothers and sisters in Christ and the like. And then there's agape love, which is less emotional, but what it is, it's saying, I don't care what you do, I still love you. And I think that both of those are part of a good, healthy relationship, because sometimes you will not feel like loving somebody, but you're going to have to love them anyway. Sometimes you'll look at his behavior or his words or his actions and say, I don't think he deserves love. And he doesn't. And you love him anyway. Because the Lord looks at us and sees our behavior and probably doesn't feel like it. Oh, you thought he wanted to have nails driven in his hands and his feet. You thought he had this emotional, wonderful feeling about that. No, he did not. He did that because of agape love. But at the same time, the Lord has this powerful emotion towards us, we, his children. He has both of these kinds of love for us. And it seems to me that that's part of what's going on. Now, why is Peter responding in this way? You may want to ask. And I think it's this. Peter is all too aware of how thoroughly he messed up. Peter is all too aware that there was a time he did not have agape love for the Lord. Had he that kind of love, he would have said, it's not worth serving Jesus. This is a difficult situation. He's on trial and I'm in danger out here, but I still love him. That would have been agape. But no, Peter's heart is big and Peter's heart is full and he wants to serve the Lord. But at that particular moment, he didn't. That's why he's not saying, Lord, I have this commitment to you that's rock solid. You remember that he had made that rash promise earlier and now he broke it. So he tells the truth. He says, Lord, I'm there. I love you. I will do my best, but I am no longer making promises. There's another thing in this context that I think is interesting, and that is when Jesus says, do you love me more than these? Now, it's hard to know what he's referring to. He could mean either, number one, do you love me more than these, the ropes and the nets and the fishing tackle and the lifestyle, these. Or he could be saying, do you love me more than these, and pointing to the other apostles. These men out here, do you love me more than they do? Now, he's certainly not going to say the second because he knows he's messed up already. Maybe the Lord is referring to, would you love me and serve me as my disciple? Or are you going to go back to fishing and fishing alone? And maybe that's the question. Now, the whole scene is evocative of a struggle Peter had undergone earlier. You might recall that in John 21 and verse 9, when they got out on land, they saw a charcoal fire in place with fish laid on it and bread. The charcoal fire is anthracite, a particular kind of charcoal, and this probably sprung a memory in Peter from John 18 and verse 18 in the courtyard of the high priest as Jesus was being tried. Now the servants and officers had made a charcoal fire because it was cold and they were standing and warming themselves. Peter was with them, standing and warming himself. Maybe the day that Peter, or the night that Peter three times denied Jesus by that charcoal fire, is now coming back in his memory as he sits by another charcoal fire on the Sea of Galilee. Notice in chapter 21 and verse 15, when they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." I like the fact that he reverts back to the Simon, son of John. When they first met, he said, "You are Simon. I shall call you Cephas." Maybe that's what Jesus is doing, but he is trying to rehab it. Do you love me more? He makes him say that three times. I think we should never forget that he had denied Jesus three times, and now he confesses Jesus three times. That he had expressed he did not know Jesus three times, and now before the other apostles, he says, "Yes, Lord, I do love you." I suspect that what's happening there is that Jesus is trying to rehabilitate him bit by bit. Notice something else in this particular context. Peter is given a job. Three times it goes like this. Do you love me? Yes, I love you. Feed my sheep. Do you love me? Yes, I love you. Feed my sheep. Do you love me? Yes, I love you. Feed my sheep. Jesus gives him a job. I think sometimes when people mess up, we are tempted to put them on probation. We're tempted to say, "Well, that's it. You can come back, you can sit there in church, but never again will we ever allow you or trust you to do anything because you messed up," or something along that line. I'd like to note some things about rehabilitating anybody, a leader like Peter or anybody who's a child of God. Number one, we rehabilitate fallen leaders. What's the other kind? Right? You don't need to rehabilitate somebody who never made a mistake. So I guess this message is only for those of us who have made mistakes, who've messed up. Notice also, Peter's not the only one. You know, aren't people funny? The other apostles kind of saying, "Hey, Peter messed up." And where were they at the crucifixion? I mean, the other Peter, Andrew, James, John, Philip, Bartholomew, Thomas, Matthew, James, son of Alphaeus, Thaddeus, Simon the Canaanite. We know where Judas was. Where were they? Oh, they were also messing up. And I think it's pretty interesting that that they weren't owning up to their mistake the way Peter was. Leaders can rise from the ashes. Rebuilding people, putting them back together the way Humpty Dumpty was supposedly not able to be put together. That's really what the Lord does. He does so much more than just forgive us. He enables us, can we use that term, to live the Christian life once again. He puts us back together in that way. Jesus reinstates only the ones who weep bitterly. I do want to make that clear. We're not talking about somebody who is arrogant and refuses to express remorse at what he'd done. Jesus does so by demanding three times that he expresses love for him, and he also, of course, charges him with responsibility. Note that the reaffirmation is sufficiently serious to meet the seriousness of the failure. Three times denial, three times confession. Those are both important parts. There's a man that I know in Zimbabwe. I guess I shouldn't mention his name, but when he was a young man, he was a very talented preacher. He was that kind of guy that you could put into a city, and within 2 or 3 years, there were 300 people meeting. He was a very able evangelist, a very able preacher, a very congenial personality. He was just one of those guys that had it. And so very quickly in the city of Mutare, the congregation he was placed in grew to 300, 350. It was a good, strong congregation. But he had a weakness. It was a flaw. He had an affair with a woman, not his wife, and the church just imploded. You know how it is. People were disillusioned. "Oh, give me a break. That was a preacher. I can't believe a preacher, a leader in the church did that." And they just imploded. Now, interestingly, he kept on preaching in that congregation. And they built back up. And so there was something like 350, 400. Once again, this is 6 or 7 years later, and he did it again. Another affair with another woman. I cannot even speculate as to what his poor wife went through those two times. But I was old enough then to be in the business meetings when the men were trying to puzzle out what they should do to use this situation for God's glory. There was anger, there were accusations, there were people who thought he should be just kicked out. Now it should be said, this man was 100% apologetic. He had come forward in worship, he had wept, he had begged for forgiveness. He was doing so also in the men's meeting as they were trying to figure out what to do. Now I'll never forget, I remember thinking I was smart enough to say, I'm going to be quiet because I want to hear what the Zimbabwean men think and how they want to handle this. They handled it in a pretty interesting way. They said to him, "Brother, we do not want you to go preach for another church. Don't go to another city. Don't go to another place. Stay here. But for a time," remember them using that phrase, "for a time, you will not preach. You will not teach Bible classes. You will not pray. You will not do anything else. But we want to help you get better. We want to help you heal. We are your brothers. We want to do that here." That congregation will have 600 people this morning in worship. He is the preacher once again. Think about the loss that would have occurred. He's an older man now in his late 70s. But I just want you to see the possibilities of putting Humpty Dumpty spiritually back together again. And you may be saying to yourself, "Brother Mitchell, I'm not a church leader, so does it matter?" Oh, it matters to the Lord. And you say, "I don't think I can be put together again." No, the King cannot put you together again. But the King can. The Lord himself can do that. And he wants to. He wants to do more than just forgive you the shattered heart, the broken pieces. He wants to put it back together again and rehabilitate you. Don't you want that? Maybe this morning, this is your opportunity to do so. Would you come to the Lord Jesus this day, be buried with him in baptism, and start to allow him to piece you together again. Would you come as we stand, as we sing?